Welcome. You're listening to the Early AI Podcast. Here we talk with thought leaders and practitioners on what's possible and practical with AI in the enterprise as we move from the current state to a future of cognitive assistance and embedded AI in all aspects of our personal and professional lives. Thanks so much for listening. If this is your first time, we invite you to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And now, here are your hosts, Seth Early and Chris Featherstone.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending upon your time zone. Welcome to today's podcast. My name is Seth Early.
And I'm Chris Featherstone. It's good to be with you again, Seth, as always.
Great to see you. And I understand you had a short week.
Yep, we got well-being days at Salesforce where I work. And so, you know, today's one of my mental health days that I get, you know, once a month. So this is the
perfect decided to spend it with us.
Well, I mean, it's you, and it's also the guest, right? This is the perfect segue into, you know, I don't know if you want to say Serenity Now or Goose Fraba or whatever the thing is that gets you, you know, nice, calm, centered into, you know, right?
Yeah, I try to get a little bit of my my mindfulness and meditation every day, and I'll tell you, it does make a huge difference. I'm really a big fan of that. So before we start, I do want to thank our sponsors. We have the Marketing AI Institute. You got to check them out. They have some wonderful courses and a conference. And Simpler Media, you might be familiar with them from their website, CMS Wire. And of course, Early Information Science. Today's guest started his career as a French naval officer, specializing in counter piracy work, which has nothing to do with AI, or maybe it will. Maybe you'll tell us what that has to do with AI. Today, he's the global segment lead for applied AI solutions at Amazon Web Services. I certainly want to hear more about that journey. He's a lover of good wine and joining us from France. Please welcome Paul Lasserre.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me today.
So Paul is one of these rare, you know, one, talents, but he's also a good friend, and I'm excited to have him on, and I'm glad that, you know, Paul, that you would agree to come on to our podcast. I think we've grown, Seth. We're past the two people that listen to our
more than two now. The other day you asked me about both of them. You said, tell me about, I said, well, both of them.
We've grown past that, and actually I'm getting, you know, some interesting questions from folks and stuff that we interact with. And, you know, so Paul, thanks for doing this. I think the cool part as we get into this podcast is really understanding, you know, how you got into it. Because there's this notion, as you know, of that AI has some mystical elements and properties to it, and it really doesn't, right? It's pretty simple and straightforward. I think if you just take that simple and straightforward approach, then you'll find the outcomes that you're really driving to can really help answer a lot of those questions, but also open 1,000 more. So, you know, with that, you know, my good friend Paul Lasserre, he and I were partners in crime at AWS, and you know, like I said, I'm so pleased to have mom. Yeah.
Likewise.
So maybe, Paul, you can tell us a little bit about your background. And, you know, I understand you were on a nuclear submarine? What was your...
In the French Navy. And thanks. And once again, thanks for having me. Super excited and so cool to have to spend some more time with Chris again. I miss Chris. Since he went to Salesforce. But to come back on your initial question, Seth, on like what's the link between like AI and chasing pirates of the Horn of Africa? Look, as much as I like to connect the dots backward on this one, I can't really say there was any relationship. The closest I can relate my experience in the Navy to what I've been doing for the past 8 years, 9 years now in AI is probably submarines, as you said, where I got the intuition during my time on nuclear submarines that if you're not familiar with submarines, when you're underwater, there are basically two things that keep you busy. The first is to figure out what's going on around you. Like you're blind, you're underwater, you're just listening, it's all passive. So try to just mask your eyes and go to the middle of crossroads and try to infer the position, speed, course of all those around you. It's a very difficult mathematical problem. The second one is classifying. Hey, is it like a Russian submarine, a whale, a French submarine, what type of vessel? And same thing. It's a problem which mathematically is pretty difficult if you try to program it, to have explicit rules to find the solution to the problem. But if you approach this problem in a machine learning way and really apply some basic supervised learning methods, then you tremendously simplify these equations. And so that was my first kind of aha moment, like, wow, this new thing is really powerful for these types of problems. And I used what I understood then to pitch in my like business school application that I wanted to combine that with my, as you mentioned earlier, with my passion for wine as a good Frenchman. And so that's what I did during school, like started a little company with a good friend of mine who was finishing up his PhD in deep learning in 2012, 2013, that was pretty early on still, not as hot as today. And we went and built a system that could help online retailers, wine retailers, to have some type of Netflix of wine online and to better recommend wine based on people's preferences. And that was the name of the company, Preferences. So that's how I made my transition. Nothing, Chris, to your earlier question. Like, it's like you need to, like, you don't need to be impressed by people who make a career in AI. Often that has to do with like just luck and just like how things come together. In my case, that was like totally by accident.
So, you know, Paul, I'd love to know how you got over to because you started part of the deep probably AI approaches to all of this, especially in customer service and, you know, really looking at it from the customer experience lens over at Genesis. How'd you get over to Genesis?
Yeah, and it's probably a little bit less glorious where the thing in wine was super like exciting. We were thrilled, but we could not make enough money to sustain ourselves in the Bay Area. So after school, we decided not to pursue this little project of ours. And so I was in the Bay Area, I was like married and a kid, a second on the way. I was like, what will I do to have a regular paycheck at the end of the month? And I figured, hey, you know what? Going into your passion, like wine for a living, might not be the best idea. You have a lot of people who want to do the same thing. A passion is meant to spend money, not to make money at the end of the day. And so I tried to identify the industries where I could apply what I learned. And talking with like the person who would become my boss at Genesis, I thought that, hey, customer support, customer experience sounds like a fantastic industry. It's huge. It's not as shiny as wine, so you might not have the same competition there. And it's at the end of the day, if you think about like what customer experience, customer support is all about, it's answering questions and fixing issues that tend to be the same, come back very often given a given organization. So it's a great machine learning problem. It's a great pattern recognition, pattern matching problem. And so that's how I got into customer experience. Once again, 2014, 15, it was early. Like AIML, I remember very well this deck from our CMO was one of the 20 futuristic trends. It was early for many of our customers and investors. So I did a few things before really starting to apply AIML at Genesis. When I think maybe 1 or 2 years later, it became obvious that contact center would be definitely changed by this technology. That's when I got the opportunity with my good friends, Connor in R&D to start an AI group that's like from scratch grew to more than 100 people in a couple of years, acquired a few companies, started a few very exciting partnerships, including AWS, Google, and others.
That's awesome. So your time at Genesis, I know that was probably built a lot of the foundations that we, you know, took, you know, later, because I was certainly grateful to have that, you know, somebody that was helping me and accelerate what I was trying to do. But at the same time, and we'll go into the history of you and I in a minute, but just in terms of those baseline foundations that were critical, right, for us to be successful. So in terms of, you know, like the pieces at Genesis, you built up a team. And then, so what was it like to take, because Genesis has been around a while, especially with the Prem products. What was it like to take these new concepts and ideas and have to shop them around, right, to the different product owners and things and try to get them pigeonholed? And what was the value prop that you would go and, because internal selling is a little bit different from, let's say, the proposition to the customers, right? What was that like?
It's a good question. So you have me dig into my memories, but I'd say double sale, like, we need to sell to our owners and the leadership of the company to, like, bet with us. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you need to go and convince all of the product owners. On the later, we've not been successful, meaning that, and I'm sure you've seen that at Cisco and other places, Chris, where you come, you see, like, the revolution that is about to happen, and you go and you pitch that to people, and some people tell you, we're already doing this, like, there is nothing new, and in fact not really.
And yeah, right. So right.
Isn't it? Yeah. And so we could not really make it work with a decentralized approach, and we ended up, and then I'll answer the first question, but we ended up building something quite centralized where we put all of the people in the same team, product managers, engineers, and pre-sales, if you will, and under the same roof, and build critical mass, an AI platform, launch the first product before it became ubiquitous and decentralized and went to all of the products, because it was hard to start in a decentralized way. Before getting there, to convince the owners and the leadership of the company, especially when it was still early and not as obvious as maybe today or 2-3 years ago, mm-hmm. we got like some like discrete under the radar POCs, proof of concept going with large customers, starting with something we called at the time predictive matching, that became predictive routing, which means that you use machine learning to better route the calls and the chats that go to customer service representative based on the outcome you try to optimize instead of rules. Like, hey, you want your NPS to go higher and control the average time the conversation lasts. These are things machine learning systems can do very well. So we did some POCs, some great successes, and that was kind of the hard evidence that really was enough to give us like get us started and then acquire Alto Cloud in Ireland and then go and from success to success grow to a decent team.
I want to pick up on that thread of you went to people with this vision and they said, yeah, we're already doing that, right? And yet they weren't. And I've seen that a lot. Right. I've seen when people say, oh, yeah, we got that. So tell me a little bit more about the delta between what people thought they were doing or what they said they were doing versus what your vision was. And how did you kind of get to that level of fidelity where you can say, no, you're not actually doing this thing that we're talking about? Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Because I've seen it quite a bit.
Yeah, and look, it really comes down to people, relationship, and human at the end of the day. I don't think there is one valid answer for all scenarios. I saw people like quickly just with like concrete evidence and just yep. by logical demonstration, mm-hmm. like come along, and others mm-hmm. Take an irrational path, protecting mm. some like baby or, sometimes it's just emotional. And I've been like right. that in some cases too. So I totally get it. And in this case, when you can't get people along with just like hard evidence, you, as Jeff Bezos said at Amazon once for two people competing on the same project, said like two is better than zero. And so you basically, you let these things run in parallel. And you accept to have a little bit like a waste of resources in a way.
Sure.
And at one point, it becomes so obvious that one is winning that it just like help everybody rally around the winner.
Mm. So like, it's doing those experiments. It's funding those POCs. It's trying these different approaches in parallel. As you say, there's some experimentation that may be a little bit of inefficiency, but that way you can actually see how these things play out, exactly. Which is interesting. You know, again, I remember seeing this in one organization, and they said, oh, yeah, we're doing all that stuff. And they said, but if you're doing all that stuff and you're not getting the results, then you're not really doing that stuff. Right? You know, it's like, what are your results? What can you measure? There's an interesting thing when it comes to measurement that you talked about improving NPS, for example, Net Promoter Score, right? Well, you know, what's the likelihood of recommending this company, and controlling the length of conversations, so time per incident or whatever that metric is. And many times those are in opposition. If you want to talk a little bit more about that, especially in the contact center, you know, there are many times conflicting objectives and conflicting measures. Yeah. How do you kind of approach that? I know it's
really- that's a good question. And on this particular example in routing, some people who manage like routing strategies into like thousands of employees contact center will tell you it's sometimes more an art than a science because mm-hmm. there are so many parameters and you need to tweak that as an instrument, a musical instrument, and and that's where, by the way, you see the power of the human intelligence, because if you let do a black box and optimize for some outcome, like every now and then, like a Spanish speaker will talk to a Japanese agent, and you know what right. I mean. There are some aspects where there is really no point to have a deep learning system like. Where explicit rules can do the job. Language is a good example, like some keyword that like trigger an escalation. Like there are plenty of examples where you really want to control with rules. That's one. Mm-hmm. Number two is to your question, how do you control the parameter? Like it's awesome if you have 1.11 extra NPS, Net Promoter Score points on average, but if all of your conversation last 10 times. Your CFO might not like it. So you basically optimize your reward function to define the weight and the limit you want to put on each of these outcomes. Like the outcome could go on the classic contact center metrics, like
first call resolution.
First call resolution, the time of the average time of the conversation, the number of like transfers, these type mm-hmm. of things, and to the more like and more to the more sales and marketing outcome. So NPS is obviously one, but like retention of customers, upsell, cross sell, and. Mm-hmm. You can have a nice mix of, hey, depending on the queue, you might want to have this trade-off for this outcome. And so that really is where the art of a good, like,
right. The human judgment yes.
comes into play. Yes. Absolutely.
Yes, yes. And I like what you said about the fact that sometimes a rules-based system is okay, right? There was there's a special topic issue in Harvard Business Review on workplace AI. Actually, my article was also featured in that on data infrastructure for AI. But in one of the articles, it talked about how less data is actually going to be better in some situations because you'll put it in the context of a rules-based or expert-based system, because there's still value in expert-based systems, there's still value in rule-based systems, there's still value in explicit knowledge capture, right? Yeah. You can't go all the way at the end of the spectrum and say, oh, it's machine learning and data and data and data and more data, more data, more data, right?
Yeah, so, at the end of the day, yeah, I totally agree. And there is a bit of hype around AI and people want to have as many AI systems in production as possible. But at the end of the day, you want to apply these technologies for amount of data where a human mind cannot make sense of the patterns, cannot really understand like the logic and connect the dots. And that's mm-hmm. where the power of a machine learning system that scale almost like infinitely is making a huge difference. But with small data sets, like why would you want to do that if
A leads to B? And in cognitive systems, we talk about cognitive AI. I always talk about that is bit of a misnomer because the systems don't think, but what they do is they reduce the cognitive load on the human. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think there's a lot of organizations that are still kind of wrestling with, well, how, I call it the last mile of cognitive AI, right? The last mile is the knowledge and terminology and expertise of the organization, right? Because you can have, say, a general learning, general language model that will interpret, you know, common terminology. But when it comes to, you know, a highly specialized, like, you know, life sciences technology company, you know, there's a lot of very specialized nomenclature and a lot of very specialized knowledge that still needs to be captured and codified, and that you can't have a general language model apply to. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that and how that works in terms of, you know, AI solutions for the call center, that explicit knowledge capture and codification?
Yeah, and that's, I don't think that's specific to contact center, but that's where, once again, you see like that the winning association is often machine plus a human. And it's true in games like chess, and that's true in like technology and industry, many industries as well. If you, like I was, we had a conference this year, like some great customer success stories based on what we call intelligent document processing, the ability to process a lot of these documents semi-automatically to do most of the job with a robot, and have like a suggestion given to an expert who is able to, for instance, for COVID in airports, to understand like what the machine assessment was and to quickly have a look and to make a call based on their like medical knowledge, but accelerate the process tremendously. In contact center, it starts with tagging the data. If you have specialized corpus, like that's what like Chris and I were like doing for the solution we launched that at AWS called Contact Center Intelligence, where you use primitives like transcription, natural language processing, translation. They are like general capabilities that AWS developed.
Like a platform service.
Exactly. Yeah. But if like just like proper names and just your medicine names and the vocabulary you might use in a given industry, in a given company, cannot be trained by default by a general system like this. And that's where having like some custom language models, some custom vocabulary, some ability to really add the specifics of your business with this like general model is quite powerful. And for that, you need people who come, who have the expertise, who tag these different semantic elements, tweak the system. And then at the end of the day, often you have human in the loop. You have like a confidence level, and you need someone with the expertise to make a call.
Right.
There was a video that I saw not too long ago where this guy was comparing AI and deep learning to what you need to do in terms of it was like a domino. You know, you flip the dominoes over and they just it starts to go down and do a lot of things automated. However, in this scenario, you know, it was like I push the domino and then it pushes a ball, and that ball pushes a stick, and that stick pushes a string, and that
Rube Goldberg apparatus.
Exactly. However, he goes, now this is the difference between what does, you know, you do in a normal automated way, but in AI and ML, there's somebody there that's every step that there has to be, that there would be a new transition into something different. There was somebody there that was, and he was like shepherding it the whole way. It was super funny because it looked like he was doing it all himself, right? But the idea was that you almost have to act like a shepherd through a lot of these pieces to make sure that, you know, like all these new questions start to come up. Am I getting the right outcome? Is it driving the right decision? Am I introducing bias? Am I, you know, doing the reinforcement learning in the right way? Am I, you know, have fully supervised learning? You know, I mean, there's all of these things now, to your point, you know, Paul, of bringing in the right people to actually help shepherd it. It really does. I think a lot of folks have this misnomer that it's just a submit and forget, hands off, and I get this wow, dazzle, amazing thing in the outcome, as opposed to it's 100% now more hands-on than it ever has been in the past, because the data is now the right data. It's the wrong data. It's the wrong data shape. It's the wrong data type. It's the wrong format, or it's all the right ones. Now pulling all those together to make some normalized sense of it is now, you know, super, super hard or important, right?
And it, and if I can, it shows true with the people you see, like with classic software, you had a bunch of like software developers like together in a room, like writing great codes. Like the best in the era of machine learning, the best teams are made of like data scientists and subject matter experts. Sometimes they don't even code. And this collaboration between people who understand the technology and people who understand the specifics, said to your previous point, I believe, are things you can't learn quickly. You need to have spent like years in the university, you've seen patients, seen the industry work, since like edge cases, come and fix the right boundaries and reward the right way. A model is usually the winning team.
Well, I mean, we know that that's, you know, that's, it's always in my mind, there's very few like true AI experts, and they're the ones that are actually writing the algorithms right now. Some of that's even questionable in terms of, because they'll even say themselves, this is my first scientific, you know, theory and notation on what I wanted to do, and this is what it should provide. Now results are always going to vary, right? It's like, you know, my hat's off to you, Paul, because, you know, you were doing early AI stuff for speech and rec without things like open source BERT models and the like, right? And, you know, we were dealing with a lot of these pieces, you know, to try to help create a better customer experience. And yet, you know, speech recognition, just one of the foundational primitives here, has been around for a long time, right? And so to your point of, well, I already do that. Yeah, but it's like driving a car. I may have a Model T Ford out there and I drive a car, but it also, you know, gets it top speed of 25 miles an hour, right? So I'm great in, or I have a golf cart. I'm really phenomenal in the neighborhood, but if I want to drive to visit my friend in California, it's going to be a rough go. So
it's interesting. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, you know, going back to, you know, your time at Genesis, you know, one, what was, you know, I think your art form, Paul, is to do exactly that, like go in and internally sell the idea and get these things adopted that then become products. What's the most, you know, your proudest moment at Genesis? And then, you know, why did you leave? You know, what was the opportunity at AWS? Because that's, you know, where you are today.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the product, I'm frankly very proud about, like when I see, especially now looking from AWS perspective and seeing the success Genesis still has in machine learning, one of our largest user of some of our AI ML products. I'm very proud of the, like, been gone a long way, and it was very fun to start it from scratch and to like design the first PowerPoint and go and do some rounds on convincing and start and fail and start differently. And so that made me very proud. I would say the thing we did, which I think is still like a work in progress, and it's still a work in progress in many organizations, is not only to come up with new AI products, but then have the ability, once you start to have 2, 3, 4, 5 different applications or products, how can you now create a new platform, a new ecosystem of AI ML products that all of them reinforce one another? For instance, we talked about this predictive routing system where you want to optimize like who talks to whom based on the outcome you seek. Like imagine now in a contact center, if you can optimize the scheduling of your agents, knowing the average like characteristic of like 1,000 callers this day at this time, and you know like the forecast of calls, and you know the attributes of your agent. Now you map two machine learning systems that each pursue the same outcomes with different boundaries, and you do that with the next system and the next system, and your entire enterprise now works together with loosely correlated applications, all working against the same goal. So that, I think, that's something we started to do at Genesis. I see as a trend in the markets, and that I spearheaded in a way, and makes me very proud.
I think you're making some really great points. Is that the synergies between these different and these different components and the different primitives that you're putting together and assembling these in these, you know, Lego building block types of paradigms, and then you're seeing lots of incremental improvements throughout the enterprise, because the same things that can answer questions for the call center agent can answer questions for the HR representative or for the engineer or for the salesperson or for the marketing person, right? So the same ideas can be applied everywhere in the organization. That's when you start seeing those really interesting. I like to say we speed up the information metabolism of the enterprise, because getting everybody to get faster solution answers to their questions. By the way, before we continue, I just want to introduce you again with Paul Lasserre, who is the global segment lead for applied AI solutions at Amazon Web Services. And I also want to once again thank our sponsors, the Marketing AI Institute, Early Information Science, and Simpler Media. So just wanted to get that in before we carry on. One question I have is proactive versus reactive customer service. That was one of the things we talked about before. Do you want to talk about how the evolution of AI and machine learning has kind of assisted? You know, usually a call center is like, oh, you have a problem, you know, now call me and now I'll react to that problem. You want to talk a little bit more about that kind of evolution to proactive versus reactive?
Yeah. I'll just quickly address the question Chris asked about, like, moving from Genesys to AWS. I'm happy to talk about contact center all day long, but one of the reasons was that I became very, very specialized in contact center. And as much as I love contact center and I loved my time at Genesys, I did not see myself necessarily do a career in contact center. And when I got the opportunity at AWS...
Not that there's anything wrong with a career in contact center.
Like, believe me, I try to spend less time in contact center. That always come back to me. And I never say no, because I enjoy it. But I had the opportunity to basically apply what I learned at Genesys and to do it across a bunch of different, like, industries and technology domains, like from media to business intelligence to many enterprise like systems families. So that was the main rationale. But to come back to contact center set on the proactive versus reactive, which is true in many domains, but you're right, customer experience is one of the best example of this shift. Where, if you think about it, for decades, enterprises, organizations have waited for people to have a problem to reach out and talk to their customers, usually unhappy customers at this time. And you can't blame this organization, because how would you do it differently? Like, do you want to pay people to just monitor every single one of your customer and
call them up and say, do you have any problems now? Yeah, do you have any problems now? Is everything okay?
It was just not possible. And now in this world of like this treasure trove of data and the ability to have systems, understand the boundary of what good looks and when someone is going out of what a good customer journey is supposed to be, then proactively reach out. And that's what's happening in so many organizations today, who understand that the technology allows this shift, this totally different way to talk to your customers. For instance, in contact center, I talked about AltoCloud, which was an acquisition Genesys made in 2017, 18, I want to say, which was specialized in predictive engagement, which is exactly what you talk about here, which is, hey, just have a system, monitor what's going on online. If you start an application for a loan online and you fill a questionnaire and you stop filling the questionnaire, it's likely that something wrong is happening. Right. So don't wait for this guy to look for the number and call you. Just like assess first assess when you should do something. Like, is it just like a temporary, like, someone like gets coffee, or is there a real issue? Assess that probabilistically. And two, use a second model to assess what's the best intervention, proactive intervention, with likely to bring this person back on the what right should be. whether that's an offer, whether that's assistance, whether that's calling you, whether that's chat, whether that's just an article. And you can apply this logic in the entire like world of customer support.
Right. It's so interesting. And, you know, you talked about just now, you mentioned what is the right intervention, right? Because what's the thing that people really hate when you walk into a store, someone walking up and saying, can I help you? No, just looking, right? Just looking. It feels like an intrusion, right? So how do you do that without being intrusive? When I go to websites, the first thing that pops up is a bot saying, how can I help you? It's like, you know, I want to exit out immediately, right?
Yeah.
So that proactivity can get kind of step over that line and be intrusive, right?
Yeah. And look, you have different ways to act on it. Like, I don't want to sound too salesy with like Amazon, but like wearing my Amazon hat. Just as a customer of Amazon.com, I'm always impressed by the proactive nature of customer support on Amazon. Not that someone is calling you or putting a chatbot in your face, but we are super data driven, so we understand what's going on. We can analyze where these journeys sometimes go left or right, and act accordingly with the right help at the time and the place you're most likely to need them.
Right.
Fixing issues before they happen based on the experience you've seen before. So proactive can mean just changing
like
the roads your customers are taking. Yeah. So they are less likely to call you.
Yeah.
And that's what we see. Like usually what works the best is like diminishing the reasons to call.
Right.
Now, you will always have people who want to call you, want to chat, want to reach on the channel of their choice, the device of their choice when they want, with their rules, and you want to be there for them. And there is no shortcut the beauty of automating what you can. You free up your people for the human touch and what really matters.
And the critical piece of this is understanding that journey and understanding it can go wrong, right? And anticipating that, and then looking for the anomalous behaviors, the ones that says, wait a minute, they should have done this. They didn't do that. Why did that happen? And if you don't understand that, you can't anticipate.
That's the key. You can't manage it if you can't measure it. And with Chris, we always told customer and our partners on this topic in just call center's voice, like start by opening the black box, transcribe the entire like months of like communications with your customer, transcribe it, analyze it, put it on the dashboard. And look at the top three issues people are calling you for before you take any action.
Right.
Just go in a room, analyze that, look at it, understand it, and then you can think about the actions that will diminish this level of issues.
Define irony, because how many opportunities, and this is for all of those out there who are trying to gather their customer sentiment off of surveys. Right, which is one, and or to your point, measure MPS or CSAT or whatever, which is interesting because, you know, to your point on the proactive, it can be overbearing and cause a negative experience. And on the other side, if they're not reactive at the right timing, that causes a negative experience. So now I'm gonna have a you're you know, just to set the scenario, you're calling in. You're mad about something or concerned about something. I can make the conversation worse or better. And then I'm going to ask you, hey, can you please take a survey at the end of this to let me know how I did? Okay, well, we know that less than 1% of people even want to take a damn survey anyway. And two, the only ones that are actually really emotionally escalated or upset are going to be the ones to take that survey, because people that are happy won't take it. Right. So now we have all these false, you know, these false negatives in terms of these result sets that are going to skew and formulate our MPS scores and our CSAT. It makes no sense at all, as opposed to trying to get markers and scores in there of the conversation at the beginning, you know, into the middle and into the end, and actually deriving out, like we're talking about, did they take the optimal journey? Did that optimal journey yield the results that they were looking for, which was solving their problem or not? And in terms of the context, and are they calling back in? I mean, Paul, we ran into that how many times with different customers that were like, well, no, you know, talk about, I already do this. No, today I've got surveys that are collecting all of this information about, you know, about how I'm doing. Mm. And you wonder why you have a loyalty or brand issue. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then companies today do it all the time. And, you know, it's helping convince them past that to say, listen, guys, let's give you some primitive building blocks. Let's just, like you said, Paul, let's take your voice conversations and just analyze crawl, walk, run, just the recorded calls that you have first and understand what's going on. And then let's maybe get into, you know, a real-time next best action where instead of, like you said, the proactiveness of being always on top of trying to make sure you're okay, creating automated connection points that are dictated by the customer. Yeah, I want you to reach out to me when there's a problem, but let me know across what channel first, right? Because of how we've interacted.
Well, and the other is to reach out to me when you say you will. I mean, I think there's a lot of process issues and there's a lot of basic stuff, blocking and tackling. And I'm so looking forward to the opportunity to tell my story about my horrendous Verizon Wireless customer service experience. But I'm gonna like drip that out over time, I think, you know. Get enough mileage out of it.
You should have
suffice it to say they were gonna call me back three times, three separate situations, and never did. But but it's like doing what you say you're gonna do, right? Understand the process. Understand what those signals are, but then even doing the basic blocking and tackling, I think is so important, right? You might be looking for these insights or these hidden motivators or these hidden signals, but you know what? There's a lot of explicit stuff that you
To field service type of activities like you're talking about, what's more frustrating than I've got this issue and they give me a window of time that they're going to call back on, like between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m., I'll get back to you, right? Anyway, let's get back. So, Paul, you made a comment, and this is one of the things that I wanted to double click on, because that's why I asked you that notion of what was intriguing about moving to AWS, right? And you mentioned that it was really the opportunity to look at so many different AI and ML problems and opportunities, right, with customers and stuff. Give me the folks that are listening to this, give us an idea of what that entails. We always seem to know customer service. What else do you get to work on at AWS, and what does that scope look like?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And on what you said just before, Seth, which is a transition to extend what we did in contact center with fulfillment, like doing some great work with companies like Pega, Workato, more on the business automation side of things. We can talk to the systems who like listen to you and get insight and can automate some of the fulfillment. So you don't stay waiting for a company who has promised to call you three times. It's all part of the same process and the same journey, and you take action. So that's one thing also that I find super excited. Outside of customer experience, but a few areas where we've seen like a lot of success with customers and analysts and all the partners of AWS in the past like year or two. I mentioned before, like United Airlines, who came talk on stage last December in Vegas, talking about how they developed in no time an application using our primitives for text recognition and NLP to very quickly be able to understand if you were compliant with your, like, coming from different countries, with your vaccination form, with your COVID test, which on average took like 7 minutes for like controllers at the gate, which was a nightmare for airlines. So that was one of the solutions. And we apply the same logic to insurance claim processing, to bank loans, and automate this process where it usually takes a lot of people and training to understand different forms possible. We also, and Chris was involved, and I saw that one of your guests was Adam Sutherland, one of an awesome colleague at AWS as well, where we developed a solution with like close to 20 companies well known in media and entertainment and education in ad tech, to same concept as in contact center, open the black box. Like you have archive, you have data, like just analyze it, understand it. So the next time you search for something, right, you want to do a special edition of your last like 50 years of like magazines, as was the case for one of our customer, instead of hiring like three interns and go and listen and watch like hours of content, just like find it very quick, create thumbnails, semi-automatically, translate and localize content in games in no time, monetize your content and your videos, especially in an era where cookies are in danger, like optimizing advertising based on content and not based on who is watching it, is also a theme that is super exciting and we do work on. And lastly, I should say, Chris, I don't know if you followed at reInvent, our conference in December, we announced something called AI for data analytics, which basically means that we worked with the leaders in business intelligence, in data warehouses, such as the Tableau, the Snowflake of the world. And basically, like the thinking is, one of the reasons why many organizations today struggle with machine learning is because they don't find the talent. Data scientists are a scarce resource today. They tend to hang out with large like technology companies, hot startups, and many organizations would like to do more with machine learning. They just don't find the people. And so what if you were to empower good data people, people who are subject matter experts, know how to manipulate data, build a dashboard, find insights, but don't code, like are afraid of a command line interface. And the idea was, let's meet these people where they are and go work with the tools they are using today, so they can move from descriptive analytics to predictive and prescriptive forms of analytics without having to learn new skills, no need to code, no need to create models. So, that's some of the concrete application of machine learning where we see a lot of interest from our customers who look for turnkey solutions with vendors that can make it easy for them to install and put in place for the business.
But they still need to understand their process, right? You can't.
It always starts with it.
If you don't understand, no magic, right? And you can't automate a mess.
Exactly.
Comes back to those fundamentals, right? You can use those platforms and applications, and those building blocks, as long as you know what your outcome is going to be, what you're trying to accomplish, what your business problem is, how you're going to measure it, all of those sorts of things.
So what's next? What's next for you, Paul? You know, I'll tell you what, I was so grateful to have you as somebody helped me drive a lot of the contact center intelligence. And congratulations, by the way, for getting that on the main stage at the big customer conference for AWS. There's a lot of and the reason why, you know, we did that was, you know, as like, you know, was mentioned, you know, if you have two solutions, is better than zero solutions, even if they're cooperative, right, and competitive. And so Paul and I created a very competitive and cooperative type of an approach to all the customer service stuff with contact centers. And it was no, you know, at first we had, it was just, you know, he and I driving this whole program, and then it did balloon and got bigger and perpetuated itself past us, which was the goal, which there was a lot of parts of the organization that didn't like, but super proud of what we did, because that was one of the, you know, that's how, you know, you're creating something that's, disruptive and or good, because
you're annoying people. You're pissing people off.
Well, it's just, you know, it's disrupting what they're doing, right?
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, so that's how we were able to do some phenomenal stuff. And then we started in the media side of things, like we talked about with Adam, you know, on the previous podcast, but we started with media and did some phenomenal things in media, but taking these building block primitives and actually applying, there's really no one size fits all. However, there are building block services that you can put together to actually just create an accelerator into something that can be tailored and, you know, customized. So now with all these data insights, so what's next for you, my friend? What are you working on now that you can share with us without going and blowing up some of the internal compliance now for AWS?
Yeah. So we don't communicate on roadmaps, as you know, Chris. So I can't share what's not been announced, but I can tell you that think about all of the hot use cases in machine learning, at least in the world of enterprise, from industrial AI to enterprise search, content moderation. Like these are all they are all hot topics where we have the capabilities at AWS. And really what excites me today and what I'm very proud to see coming back to our discussion about I'm already doing it. I've seen that Genesis, I've seen that in the world of startup, I'm seeing it sometimes at AWS. There is some pride around developing your own machine learning system back in-house. And the truth is that a small company that is very specialized in a given industry will likely not be known for transcription. And so my message often to customers and our partners is really like pick your battle. Like if a machine learning system is not going to differentiate your business, like do something else. Like just focus your engineers, your talent in data science to the path that is really proper to your business, what you want to be known for. And I've seen that really go ahead.
Differentiator, right? It's
exactly.
You can't outsource your competitive advantage, but you shouldn't be not part of your competitive difference.
And when you say it, it sounds so natural and obvious, right, that you would not believe the number of companies that kind of outsourced initially their machine learning to a group of data scientists were excited by like doing cool shit, excuse my French. And they could beat Google, they could beat AWS on this like transcription, translation, OCR system, you name it. But there is really no point in my opinion. So that's one of my messages. Right. I was fortunate enough to have like a discussion with Andrew Wang a couple of years ago where I was telling some of these challenges with engineers. And he told me, look, Paul, that's exactly the same here. I work with some of the most talented students and they could do it all themselves. And I constantly have to find today focused on the thing that is going to they want to be known for, and the way you phrase it is don't sprint in front of the train, and it sticks with me, and that's what I repeat to my customers and partners. Like, of course you can beat like a large company like in the short term, like on this particular problem, but you will probably not win in the long run, and this battle to start with is not meaningful, it's not relevant for you. So pick your battle. Decide what you want to be known for, and just like leverage the work done by the entire industry and build on top of it. And I think like most people get it today and apply that logic, and that's why we see so much fast innovation in AI.
That's great. Thank you so much. I love that. I didn't catch how you phrased it, but it's don't sprint in front of a train. Like don't.
Correct.
That you'll win in the short term, but you won't win in the long term.
That's exactly the idea. Yeah.
Right. You don't want to be hit by that freight train. Yeah.
Well, you know, a phrase we used at Amazon a lot was let's not break into jail.
Let's not break into jail. Yeah. Well, listen, we come to the end of our time today. It really has been a tremendous pleasure speaking with you, Paul. This has really been a lot of fun. And I do want to, again, remind people our sponsor, Simpler Media, which is CMS Wire, Early Information Science, and the Marketing AI Institute. And again, Chris, wonderful having you to help out with this and be our partner in crime. And Paul, fantastic having you on. We'd love to have you on again. And this is some tremendous insights. And all right, guys, thank you so much. Have a wonderful week and weekend, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. Paul. It's a lot of fun.
Take care, pal.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Early AI Podcast with your hosts, Seth Early and Chris Featherstone. We hope you enjoyed the program and took away some ideas that you can start to implement in your organization right now. If you're stuck and need help, check out www.early.com for information about Early Information Science consulting services. And of course, check the show notes for links to any resources we mentioned today. That's all for now. See you next time.